there. Thanks for listening to Let's Talk Withdrawal, a weekly discussion on antidepressants and the issues surrounding them.
Hello, this is James, and welcome to episode 12 of Let's Talk Withdrawal, a weekly podcast discussing antidepressants and mental health. This week, we have an interview with Dr. Lucy Johnstone. Dr. Johnstone is a clinical psychologist, trainer, speaker, and writer, and a long-standing critic of the biomedical model of psychiatry. She has worked in adult mental health settings for many years, alternating with academic posts. Lucy has authored a number of books, including Users and Abusers of Psychiatry and A Straight-Talking Introduction to Psychiatric Diagnosis, as well as a number of articles and chapters on topics such as psychiatric diagnosis, formulation, the psychological effects of ECT, and the role of trauma in breakdown. I was keen to talk to Dr. Johnstone about our reliance on the concept of diagnosis and how that doesn't fit well with psychological or emotional distress, and how a predominantly biomedical view tends to lead to a purely medication-centered approach to mental health care. Dr. Johnstone, thanks so much for talking to us today. Could I start by asking you to tell us a bit about your background and how you came to be working in the mental health field?
Okay, well, I'm a clinical psychologist. So for people who aren't clear about the difference between a psychologist and a psychiatrist, I'm not medically trained. I'm not a doctor. Psychologists are mainly trained to help people by understanding the context of their lives, by talking therapies, but also to work with systems to try to help people generally to have a more better understanding of the psychological and the social factors that lead to people's distress. And they also do a lot of training and research sometimes and so on. And I guess, like a lot of people who end up in this field, you know, I was quite an unhappy young person, spent a lot of my time thinking about what that was about, read quite a lot of about it from quite a young age, and really developed a strong interest in what is it about the way we live that can drive people to extreme distress or to the states we sometimes call madness.
Thank you. And I just wanted to go on and ask a little bit about your books, Users and Abusers of Psychiatry, published in 1989, which was updated in 2000, Formulation in Psychology and Psychotherapy, published in 2013, and A Straight-Talking Introduction to Psychiatric Diagnosis in 2014. They are all critical of the use of psychiatric diagnoses, and I just wondered if you could help me understand why a diagnosis might not be a particularly good thing for everyone.
So all of those books have a common theme. I wrote the first one when I'd only been qualified for a couple of years, and certainly they're all very critical of psychiatric diagnosis, and in a more general sense they're critical of the whole way that we have about understanding extreme states of what I would call emotional distress, despair, suffering, any of those kind of words. So my starting point is that we need a very different way of understanding why people become extremely distressed. And that's not in any way to deny that people can be extremely desperate and despairing and suicidal and anxious and overwhelmed and sometimes quite out of touch with everyday reality. It's not to deny that, but it is to say that we need better explanations. The explanations we have at the moment are not, in my view, based on the evidence. And moreover, they're not on the whole helpful. So what we see is a system where people are told that they're suffering from some kind of medical illness. And of course, if you think that's the main problem, you're much more likely to think that drugs have a very large role to play. And the end result of that, as I've observed throughout my career, is that although that can sometimes be helpful, in the longer term, it tends to trap people in a kind of psychiatric patient role, becoming dependent on external solutions like pills, which are not actually going to solve people's life's problems. And you end up, to put it briefly, turning people with problems into patients with illnesses. And, you know, I'm strongly opposed to that way of looking at things, and I'm strongly opposed to practice that's based on that kind of narrow model.
Well, certainly when I was reading A Straight Talking Introduction, what I really liked about it was the jargon-free approach to explaining these things, which I found really helpful. And also the phrase blame or brain leapt out at me in terms of trying to understand the difference between physical illness or injury being apparent and treating somebody as if their difficulties in life are imaginary.
I think we actually have very unsophisticated ways of debating this in society as a whole, not just in mental health. So it's almost universally accepted in the media, on ordinary people on the street who may say they don't know much about mental health. Everywhere you read about it, hear about it, that people are suffering from some kind of medical illness. I've got depression, as opposed to I feel miserable, desperate. You know, I have schizophrenia, as opposed to I have unusual and sometimes frightening experiences, and so on. And the message that you giving someone a diagnosis is giving someone that message. You have a medical illness called clinical depression or bipolar disorder and so on. And one of the problems is we seem to have taken on this explanation so uncritically that whenever anyone starts questioning it, you get this often very tiresome kind of debate. Oh, you're still denying that anything's wrong with someone. And of course, that's not the case. Oh, so you're saying that, you know, your brains have nothing to do with it at all. And of course, that's not the case. So we actually need a much more sophisticated way of understanding why people might become depressed and the language we should use about that. And you're right, I'm very, very keen that we should use ordinary language, ordinary descriptions for what in the end are common human experiences and understandable responses to the circumstances of people's lives. So in my view, that means actually getting rid of diagnosis. And the reason I wrote a straight talking introduction to psychiatric diagnosis is because the people who most need to be informed about these debates, that is the people who are being diagnosed, are least likely to be told that these are controversial terms, that this is not the only way of looking at it, that there are alternatives. So my book really isn't about saying you're not allowed to use this language or you have to think of it in this way. That is up to the individual. But I think the individual should be making an informed choice about this is the kind of language that makes sense to me. This is the kind of explanation that makes sense to me. I really, really strongly believe it's not scientifically or ethically justifiable to tell people as though it was undisputed fact that they have bipolar disorder, have schizophrenia, have clinical depression, have a personality disorder. That's one way of looking at it. It's a highly disputed way. I would say a way that isn't supported by the evidence, and I would say a way that has significant limitations, and actually there are alternatives.
Well, I agree, and I found the book really refreshing because it's only recently in my own personal journey that I've come to see my own diagnosis as disempowering. I thought, okay, I have a diagnosis now, I have a sick note from my employer, I can now apply for certain benefits, and there are many other things that are part and parcel of the system that you find yourself in. But you're right, as soon as I had that diagnosis, a doorway opened into a medication pathway of treatment with no discussion or consideration about other areas of my life or other options. So I feel that my diagnosis closed many doors to me.
I'm afraid that's a very, very common experience. And, you know, it's I think, astonishing for some people to realise there's a whole different world out there, a different way of looking at things, which they are not only not introduced to, they are actively discouraged from thinking about things in that way. You know, it can go down very badly if you question your diagnosis. And I do think for certain practical purposes, most people will need to use their diagnosis to get access to benefits, to have sick notes. So we're in a state of, I hope, changing from one system to another. And in this intermediate stage, of course, people need diagnoses for certain practical purposes. And I wouldn't want anyone to find it hard to get, you know, the benefits they need and so on. But for me, the key question is, do you have to take this on as the one and only true explanation of your difficulties? And do you have to take on the identity of a mentally ill person? And I don't think anyone should have to do that unless it really happens to be a way that makes most sense to them. But nobody, virtually nobody, is given a choice.
You're right. It is empowering to realise there are different ways of thinking about this. And I thank you for making that clear. Dr. Johnstone, I wanted to move on now to talk about the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is currently the key tool for psychiatric diagnosis. I'm aware that in recent times it's been growing with more and more disorders being added every time it's reviewed. It's clearly time to think again, and I've heard you say that too. What should we replace that view of the world with?
Okay, I'll talk a bit about DSM first. DSM, as you rightly say, is sometimes called the psychiatrist's Bible. So it's a list of all the different ways in which people can apparently have mental illnesses or mental disorders. About 1900, we thought there were three ways. Now we apparently think there's 300 plus ways. So it's revised every few years. The most recent edition came out in 2013. So that's called DSM-5. And as many people will know, because it actually reached the national papers, there was a huge amount of controversy about this ever-expanding manual. And I think anyone can see that some of the things it's putting forward as new types of mental illness are, you know, normal everyday behaviours, or in some cases, problems, but not illnesses. So a child who has temper tantrums, you know, somebody who occasionally eats too much, people who are children who fidget too much at school. Do you know what I mean? It's being this kind of medicalization of everyday life is being expanded. And some of those examples are obviously ridiculous. But the problem with the manual is that it goes further than that, because if we are actually going to say that these are medical illnesses, actually what we have to do at some point is to be able to point to some evidence for that. And we hear an awful lot of stuff about genetic flaws of various types and chemical imbalances and all the rest of it. But what very few people realise is that there's never been any actual evidence that there's such things exist, that they can be identified, and that we can demonstrate that they cause the kind of various types of distress that lead people to be given a diagnosis. There's no evidence for that. It's hard for some people to believe that, because, you know, these myths have been spread so widely. Interestingly, some of America's most senior psychiatrists are now backtracking on the chemical imbalance theory, and are not only saying they never said it, they're saying this has been invented as a way of discrediting them. The idea that people have been spreading a lie, that they've been, you know, informing people have chemical imbalances. So there's a significant amount of backtracking, but the bottom line is we're left with a list of so-called medical illnesses without any concrete evidence that they are, in fact, medical illnesses, mainly caused by something going wrong in the brain or body. And what few people are aware of is that even the people who put together this and previous editions of DSM are admitting that, in fact, they've been some of its most strongest critics. So right at the heart of establishment psychiatry, the very people who drew up these manuals are actually saying, we need a different system. Their best defence, if you challenge them, is, well, this is what the best we have at the moment, so we have to hang on to it at the moment. They actually don't have a stronger defence than that. Now, they're not telling clients that. You know, they're telling clients that this is something accurate and true. But again, the implications of the very people who put this stuff together are saying this won't work, we're investing billions of dollars in an alternative, are absolutely profound, and they don't filter down to the people who accept these terms as though they were real scientific terms. So diagnosis, as we know, it is on its way out, whether you agree with it, whether you disagree with it, whether you support it, whether you don't. It's so important people know about that.
Well, thank you for clarifying that for us. And so what would an alternative approach look like, do you think?
So what is the alternative to diagnosis? Well, in a way, it's very, very simple. People come along to mental health services with kind of stories to tell. They come along for reasons. And very often they're quite well aware themselves what those reasons are, but sometimes they're not. Sometimes it takes a while to work out what it is and put the pieces together. But actually, in a general sense, what we need to do instead of diagnosing people is listen to their stories. And one of the most damaging effects of diagnosis is to kind of screen out those stories. As you said, people stop asking. They've got this answer or something, what they think is the answer. We treat the answer mostly with medication. We stop asking what's gone on in your life. So listening to people's stories can be done in all sorts of ways. And it doesn't have to be some fancy professional skill. And, you know, it could be about writing or talking to your friends or reading or, you know, all sorts of things. Art, you know, people find a range of ways of expressing themselves. But I've become very interested in a particular way of, which is a kind of semi-structured way of putting together stories, which is called formulation. So formulation's a bit of a jargon term, and I don't like jargon. But in essence, what it is, it's a particular version of structuring somebody's story. And it has it's quite widely used in psychiatric services, or at least lip services paid to it. So I think it's quite a good starting point if you're working in services and want to try and do things a bit differently. And all clinical psychologists like myself have formulation as a core skill. We all spend a large part of our 3-year training practicing, you know, developing formulations with people. So in essence, it's a way to sit down, you know, one-to-one with someone who's come along to services and put together a kind of conversation where the professional is bringing their knowledge of research and evidence and their clinical experience, and the person sitting in front of them is bringing along their expertise in their life and what's happened to them and what it meant to them. So those are two equally important forms of expertise, if you like. and working together, they can put together a kind of way of making sense of it, a narrative. But it's not a narrative that's pulled from nowhere. It's a narrative that is actually based on quite a lot of evidence about what we know about events in people's lives and how they affect them and how they tend to cope.
Well, it sounds very much to me like an approach which identifies open questions which can lead to discussions about treatment that might be more suitable for the individual, whereas the diagnosis discussion is very narrow and limited, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. I mean, a formulation is very much, or certainly should be, collaborative, whereas diagnoses are expert imposed and that's it. And the main purpose of formulation, as you say, is to think together about the best way forward. I'm not sure if I'd even use the word treatment, because actually treatment has sort of medical overtones, doesn't it?
It does, you're right.
So some of what you might be thinking about is very practical things like, you know, childcare, or have you got all your benefits, or all the rest of it. Or, you know, do you need to be spending more time, you know, looking after yourself or whatever. And it might or might not be kind of some kind of therapy or counselling. Wouldn't have to be. It might be to do that. So it's never finished. It's an evolving process. And the way I like to think of it is a kind of our shared best guess about what's going on, which we'll come back to, which is probably incomplete, but which can be a reasonable guide to what to do next. And I would hope that, as you know, good formulation as well as suggesting a way forward should also be helpful in other ways, in the sense of helping the person to think, this person's really listened to me, this person has taken the trouble to understand me. There could be a way forward, because a formulation is very much about how you survived and what you can do to get further on in your life. It's not, you know, about what's wrong with you, it's just as much about what's right with you and how you've managed to survive. And the overall message, I think, is, you know, your difficulties are understandable, you know, in the circumstances we've been talking about, and anywhere else in those same circumstances might well have helped the same way. So that's a very normalizing message, as opposed to a pathologizing message.
Thank you. And related to that, if you could radically change the way that we treat mental or emotional distress, what change would have the most impact and benefit the most people in need of support?
I mean, we need to change our whole model. That's a very big step. And diagnosis is the basis and acts as a support for the current model, the illness model. So I guess if you removed diagnosis, that would be a very big change. And if you had instead an approach that's based on listening to people's stories, that would be brilliant. I mean, you can look at it from the other end and say, well, what is it that's going to be most effective in, you know, reducing the amount of distress people experience in the first place? And if you look at it from that end, then you would want to really be tackling an awful lot of stuff that is known to increase emotional stress throughout society. So, you know, it's the obvious things. It's poverty, it's injustice, it's deprivation, it's discrimination, it's social inequality. You know, we need to live in a fairer, more just society. That would significantly reduce the amount of distress that people experience. But they're two sides of the same coin, in a way. If you remove diagnosis and started to listen to why people come into services, you would find those themes emerging. And it would become very obvious that, as well as offering people help on a one-to-one level, we need to look at, you know, further upstream at the conditions that allow distress to flourish. A much more social model of mental distress.
That's crucial, isn't it? Because if we continue to medicalise distress and continue to treat it with a predominantly pharmaceutical approach, then there's no reason to address those social drivers, and we can pretend that it's an individual's problem and try to medicate it away.
Well, that's exactly it. And depending on how critical you want to be about the psychiatric system, you know, there are a number of critiques that say that fundamentally that's what psychiatry is about. I mean, psychiatry as a whole, not just the profession of psychiatry, but what is it doing in society? It is performing a function of social control. It's kind of silencing people at one level, so they themselves believe that their difficulties are due to some flaw in themselves, and it's preventing the rest of us having to address the causes. It's sweeping up society's casualties, if you like. And that's not to say that's the individual motivation and purpose of people going to mental health services. Of course it isn't. But if you take a broader perspective, that, you know, I think that's quite a convincing argument.
It is. It's quite frightening, isn't it? Because we place our trust in sound medical science and evidence, and we assume that the approach is the same, be it a broken leg or emotional distress, but they are based on different premises entirely.
Yeah, it is an absolutely false analogy. We see it everywhere. You know, it's like taking insulin for diabetes. It's as real as a broken leg. You know, it is nonsense. The analogy is totally false.
Thank you. And talking a bit more now about pharmaceuticals and medications, and I wondered if I could ask for your personal reflections on the use of psychiatric drugs for the treatment of mental or emotional distress, particularly given that in the UK, the number of antidepressants that we have prescribed has doubled in the last decade to 63 million items in a single year. It's certainly a success story for pharmaceuticals and maybe also for psychiatry. But for people like me who have not been helped at all by psychiatric medications, this is a very worrying trend.
Well, the figures you just quoted are, of course, scandalous and shocking, absolutely shocking. And one of the ways we don't seem to make connections when we talk about that is when we know quite well that it's in areas of high deprivation that you have most antidepressant use. Blackpool, Merthyr Tydfil, I think, are the two highest users of per head of population antidepressants, so-called antidepressants. So what does that say? Is that a pure coincidence? Why are chemicals so much more likely to be imbalanced in areas of high deprivation? It doesn't add up. And if we're flooding these places with antidepressants, why aren't the population more cheerful? Do you know what I mean? It really doesn't add up. So you can see the contradictions. So general reflections. Well, I mean, of course, I don't know anyone who'd want to deny that that drugs are helpful for some people at some times. So if you're in a state of extreme distress, you need something to get you through the day, then medication or psychiatric drugs, which actually I don't think are properly called medication, can be of help. But again, that the whole illness model tends to kind of skew our view of what psychiatric drugs are and what they do. So I'm sure you've come across Joanna Moncrief's work, and she's a critical psychiatrist who puts forward a very useful way of looking at it, I think, which is a contrast between a disease-centred model, like antibiotics for your chest infection, medication that directly targets something that we know has gone wrong in the body, and thus you stop coughing and all your symptoms disappear, versus the drug-centred model, which is like the analogy much more like taking alcohol because you're anxious about meeting your friends in the pub. So in a drug-centred model, yes, these drugs do have effects, but they have general effects, not targeted effects on some kind of disease process. And they would have the same effects on anyone, whether or not they're psychiatrically labelled or not, and they cannot really legitimately be called treatment. So we don't say that alcohol is a treatment for social anxiety, nor do we say that social anxiety is caused by a lack of alcohol in the brain. So on a drug-centred model, yes, these drugs may have some useful, particularly short-term effects, but actually as long as we're thinking of them in a disease-centred way, and of course terms like antidepressants and antipsychotic tend to suggest that very strongly, then we're going to be giving people quite the wrong messages, which are along the lines of you've got to take this and it'll get you better, which is giving far too much power to the drug and setting people up for a kind of lifetime of dependence. And we're going to be very reluctant to allow people to have drug-free treatment, and we're going to try and insist that they should take drugs, even if they themselves don't find them helpful. And we're going to feel we're doing the most effective thing we can just by giving people the drugs, when actually that's almost certainly not the case. So we have a very unhelpful way of looking at it. And actually, if we had a different understanding of mental distress, then drugs would be able to find a much more limited way and probably would be mainly used in the short term, because we also, of course, need to take on the very overwhelming and serious amount of evidence that over the long term, drugs not only don't help people's problems, they actually create disability. On average, that's all types of psychiatric drugs appear to create disability. There's quite a lot of evidence supporting that. And that's scary. And within our current model, we can't afford to admit that, because within our current model, that's the main intervention we've got.
I agree. And what also seems to be the case is that the very information that would allow us as service users to decide for ourselves whether medication is right for us or not is not readily available. I don't feel that I could make an informed choice when I started my antidepressant drugs.
Well, I absolutely agree with you. It is about informed choice. Absolutely. If people don't want to listen, or, if people know it already, or if people want to listen and make a different choice, that's absolutely up to them. But it is not justifiable for people not to be given an informed choice. And given that that's the standard situation, then people like yourselves have understandably, and I think, very much to your credit, felt the need to fill the gap. And it does feel difficult. It does feel difficult. It feels a lot more difficult when you say, oh, here's some new evidence. Do you know what I mean? About, which happens a lot. This feels like a much more fundamental and difficult thing to say. Difficult to hear as well.
It is, but I thank you and others like you who are willing to challenge the status quo and to think about the paradigm shift that is needed in how we approach mental and emotional distress. We need a lot more like you, so thank you.
Not at all. Well, isn't easy on any side of the debate, but you know, the debate has to happen.
I'm really grateful to Lucy for taking the time to chat with me for the podcast. She's given me a lot to think about, and I'm sure the same is true for you too.
Feedback.
I'd love to hear from you, so please get in touch. You can email me on feedback@jfmoore.co.uk. I've received so many supportive emails, and I'm really grateful for each and every one. And I wanted to highlight this one in particular. I work as a GP, and I came across your podcast on iTunes. Your interviews have really opened my eyes to an issue that I was aware of but didn't know enough about. Because of your interviews, I've thought long and hard about how I advise patients who want to stop taking their antidepressant medications. I hope many more GPs and psychiatrists listen to these real experiences and put the knowledge to use in their own practices. Well, thank you so much for that email. I'm really pleased to hear that the message is getting out to the wider community of people who not only have used, but are responsible for prescribing psychiatric medications. Also, I'm really keen for as many as possible to discover this podcast on iTunes, and you can help that happen by leaving a review and a star rating. If you're listening in iTunes now, please leave us a review. It takes just a couple of minutes, but it makes a big difference. Thank you. Finally, if you're struggling with withdrawal yourself and don't know where to turn, there are some excellent resources listed on my website, jfmoore.co.uk. Please go and have a look.
Please do not increase, decrease, or stop your psychoactive prescription medication without the advice and support of a medical or mental health professional.
Thanks so much for listening today, and until next time, take care.
Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk Withdrawal. Come back next week for more news and views. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave a review and subscribe in iTunes.